This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to... The winner, it's a tie. And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Risch. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hello.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
Rebecca, we're actually going to start with you today. We have two interviews, and you'll be first up with your conversation with Emerald Fennell, the writer and director of Saltburn. She's one of the most consistently interesting people to talk to about her work, I think. And from what I understand from this conversation, she really didn't disappoint this time. There's a lot to get into with Saltburn. What did you guys talk about?
I really love how her mind works. You know, I know her films are polarizing, but I think she is doing things that are really interesting. She loves making audiences feel uncomfortable, and I really respect that and admire that and think she pulls it off a lot of the time. I really wanted to get into her writing process this time because the last time I spoke to her, we couldn't because the writers were still on strike. And, you know, she really keeps her projects a secret from literally everyone, even her producers, until, you know, she feels like the script is a place to share them. And I thought that was a really interesting way to go about it.
Do we need to give a spoiler warning to anybody? I think we're going to talk more about Saltburn on the episode later this week. But if people haven't seen it, I assume that there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of twists in store, but I'm guessing she didn't spoil too much.
Yeah, I feel like she's really figured out how to be careful about spoiling her own movies. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago before it was out. So I think you're pretty safe. I mean, I would recommend seeing it before you listen to the full thing, but she doesn't spoil any surprises. It's really about her process in finding the actors and writing and how she really pulls this kind of stuff off.
All right. Well, let's hear all about it in your conversation with Saltburn's Emerald Fennell.
I'm so excited to welcome the writer-director of Saltburn to the podcast today, Emerald Fennell. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking about this film for a while since I did a first look before Telluride. But now, by the time this comes out, we'll be very close or at release. So I'm curious, you know, how we're a few weeks away while we're talking. So I'm curious how you feel when you know your movie's finally coming out to a wide audience and to the world.
I think probably the first time we spoke before anyone had seen it, there's a lot of trepidation because you know, it's sort of like presenting your baby and saying, do you think my baby is beautiful? And people saying, no, actually, it isn't. Or, you know, taking your clothes off and asking people to give you like honest feedback. So there's always that thing. But actually, now that it's been playing to people, you know, festivals and all of that, the response has just been so thrilling. And it's just so fun because this time, the last film came out during COVID. But this one, I'm getting to kind of go around the country and like meet everyone afterwards. And it's just so wonderful to have the kind of conversations in person with people because, you know, like Promising a Woman, this film in many ways is sort of, you know, quite complicated. And you get into it. You really get into those conversations quite deep, quite fast. Mm-hmm. So it's really, yeah, I'm excited actually.
With this film in particular, I was wondering what that reaction experience is like for you, because I imagine depending on the person and their walk of life and their own experiences, the reactions could be so different to this story. Have you had any that have been extremely surprising? Like, I didn't think of that at all. But, you know.
Yeah, totally. I think, honestly, what I'm learning is that I suppose that because the movie has a lot of, you know, quite transgressive, you know, sex stuff. And I don't know, there's a lot about it that's very, very dark. You know, it's a very, very dark comedy, mm-hmm. you know. And so I think, you know, I think a lot of people certainly at the beginning were concerned that it would be, you know, that it wouldn't kind of... That it might be a bit too transgressive or whatever, but actually I've really found that people in general, like, really love it, and actually from all walks of life. There was a woman with her husband, and she must have been in her 70s at one of the festivals, and she came up to me afterwards, and she was kind of shaking, and she just said, like, I just needed to come and find you because I needed to tell you, like, nothing's ever touched. There's just something, just, I feel like something's just kind of come out that I've never felt before. And that's just so exciting. And of course, you know, you don't expect that from a woman who's just bought a ticket in her, you know, it's just like, it's just, that's exactly what I wanted this movie to do, was to kind of hit that spot, which is kind of uncomfortable, but pleasurable. But, you know, of course, there are a lot of, you know, every conversation is different. Every room is different. That's what's been so exciting, is like, you know, in some rooms, it's like total pin drop silence. In other rooms, it's super rowdy. And then, yeah, a lot of anecdotal evidence of quite a lot of sexy behavior that happens after people watch the movie. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of, you make something that you love and you hope other people understand and love it too. And so it's like, it's fun meeting everyone.
Yeah. So speaking of Promising Young Woman, you know, after that was such a success as your directorial debut, and, you know, you won an Oscar, there was a lot of good things that I assume came after that. And I also assume there was probably some outreach of, like, do you want to direct something that isn't something you wrote? I'm sure there were opportunities that were coming your way. How did you decide that, you know, Saltburn would be next for you?
I think, I mean, it was a really, yeah, it was kind of an extraordinary time. And I think also, again, because of the pandemic, I was at home, mm-hmm. which kind of in a funny way meant I was very pregnant and had a very young child already. So I was sort of, in many ways, not really exposed to, you know, what was happening in a funny way. And I think what I realized early on is that I was, yeah, getting lots of incredible offers. I mean, just unbelievable things that, you know, and with people I've wanted to work with my whole life, and just so tempting, so gorgeous, so many things that could have been just so fun and amazing. But what I realized about myself, I think now, is that I can only do one thing at a time. Mm. And I can only do it in sort of secret. You know, and then I give, you know, I don't even show my husband, or I don't show anyone until something's completely finished. So nobody knows what it even is. And it's sort of the only way that it can, I think it's the only way that I can, like, comfortably, happily work. And so I said quite early on to my lovely, like, managers and agents, like, don't tell me, don't show me, because it's too tempting. And these offers, it's not at all that I'm sort of, you know, turning my back in a sort of, haughty way. It's more that I know that there are things I just couldn't bear to turn down. So it's sort of, I realized, especially when you've got young kids, you can only do so much, and you need to choose the thing that you want to do next. And I've been thinking about Saltburn for years and years. It was always the next thing I wanted to make. But in many ways, this version of it that we ended up making is sort of much more, I started thinking about it maybe 8 years ago, but I feel like this version of it is certainly feels post-COVID. It's much stickier. It's much more preoccupied with closeness and intimacy and sex, maybe, than perhaps it would have been. But I think we've all felt so apart from each other. Yeah, it's interesting how something that you've been thinking about for a long time changes. Hmm. Under circumstances.
And we haven't been able to talk about the writing process until now, since the, you know, the strike for writers has finally ended. So how did this process, writing Saltburn, differ from Promising Young Woman for you? Do you always write in a similar fashion?
It didn't really differ. You know, the difference was that Promising Young Woman, wonderful, lucky chap, had optioned it from the idea. So they knew what it was going to be about, more or less. before I handed it in. But even so, I don't think I did an outline or any of that thing, those things. I just asked them if they would let me kind of write the script. And with this one, you know, as I say, nobody knew anything about it until I gave in the kind of completed script. And for me, the kind of solitude of it, it's very much an imaginary world. And I've learned over time, the more people are allowed in there, the less real it becomes to me and the less detailed. And also in a sort of some sort of perverse way, I sort of lose interest. It has to feel private for it to be really honest. And especially if you're talking about the sorts of things I like to talk about, which is sort of, you know, self-delusion and lying and the sort of things we fantasize about kind of secretly. It's not really something you can sit in a conference room and develop and then write an outline for, you know?
Yeah.
So my writing process, just over the course of years, I just sit and think and daydream, and I visit worlds, and these worlds just become more and more fixed, and then the conversations that happen there become more and more fixed, and, you know, people come and people go, and there are characters who are there for a while but don't work out or become someone else, and then I write it down when I know it's finished, when I finish thinking about it, when I can't think about it anymore, when the things that are happening in the rooms are the same every time, that there's kind of nowhere else to explore. Like I've kind of finished the game, I guess, as it were. And then I write it down, and I try as much as possible not to redraft or to only redraft, you know, at certain points. So, you know, after I've met all the actors and we've had a rehearsal and they've said things that really sparked and are exciting, or, you know, we're on set and something has to be done for practical purposes. But for me, the more the dialogue is reworked in particular, the more it loses its sort of vividness and kind of honesty.
So your process, because I think the one of the slogans that we live by is writing is rewriting, but that's not really your process, it sounds like.
But it is my process. It's just not on paper. If you wrote down every draft that I've been thinking of, it's thousands and thousands and thousands. It's just not on paper because I can do it. Of course, I've had to do that process, like for lots of other things for my whole career, really, especially with the books and and, you know, working with other people and other stuff. Of course, that's part of it. But for me, when it comes to these things, you know, the writing has to be done in my head. So it is redrafted. It's a kind of cheat to say it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes me sound like
no. I can tell a lot of the work is in your
but,
head.
It's sort of like transcribing. It's a bit like automatic writing then when I write it down, because I know it. I know all the dialogue already. You know, I've been saying it for years and I've been trying out different things. And I just think, like, once it's black on white, it has happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there are small things that can be improved upon. But honestly, I'm more likely to write a whole new scene later, having spoken to the actors, than I am to kind of, you know, zone into an old one.
Yeah. Who reads your script first when it is finally on paper? Are there certain people beyond, you know, your reps that you send it to?
My husband, who is really, really wonderful and the perfect kind of combination of honest and encouraging. And my mother, who is also a writer, who's a brilliant writer, and who is, she's, I think, completely unshockable, you know? And so she's a really fun person. I know that if I shock my mother, I've gone too far, because she really has no, you know, if I have a dark sense of humor, I think my mother really is kind of even more intense in that regard. So, yeah, so I think those two I always want to show it to. But you know, again, it's usually just to have a conversation and then to make me sort of think, and then I'll tend to show it to them, and then I usually won't change anything, but I'll show it to a wider group. Mm-hmm. And what I'll try to do is keep everyone's thoughts in mind so that, then when I meet the actors and all that kind of stuff, everyone, you know, then I can just minimize the redrafting. I have, you know, you just have comment, you know, sometimes people, lots of people will say the same thing. Yeah. Lots of people will like something or not understand something. So then you can, but you can keep that. I don't like to do it every time somebody has notes because it just dies on its ass for me.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
I've talked a lot about the performances in this. I think they're incredible, obviously, particularly Barry and Jacob, I think, really deliver, and Rosamund Pike, who we can talk about too. But when you meet with, you know, an actor like Barry or Jacob and you're trying to cast these roles, what do you do with them? Do you do formal auditions? Is it just more of a conversation? What are you looking for to know they're the right person?
It's really interesting. I think it's a combination of things, but I like to meet people for usually, especially for the kind of the bigger roles, I will always want to just meet people first and have a coffee because I just want to know, really, I don't know what it is exactly, but it is a chemistry thing. And it's not just a chemistry thing between them, but it's between us because I just want to know what kind of a person I'm dealing with, I suppose. Partly it's because the way that I like to work is that, you know, everyone has the same kind of shit trailer. All of the actors have a green room on set, you know, whether they've got a line or they're the lead. And, you know, so nobody goes back to base to change. Nobody's ever in their trailer. Everyone, cast and crew, eat together every day, everyone. And so it's important to me early on to kind of say, like, this is going to be a communal act of kind of trust and like creative industry, and we're not gonna, you know, and there are lots of people who can't for whatever reason, who don't like that, who need other things to make it work for them. So there's partly that practical side of things, but it's an honesty thing. We have to start looking at very complicated things very early on, and so I need to kind of know that people, I guess, are open to that, whether they're honest, I suppose, or, you know, or as honest as any of us can be, or even if they're honest about lying. You know, so a lot of my questions will be things like, do you like being famous?
Right.
For example, it's an interesting, it doesn't matter how people answer. It's just looking at where are these little, are we going to be able to get into this, honestly? Mm. And, you know, when you're making films like this, you really need to know that. And so then, you know, so I meet people and then if I haven't seen enough of their work or I need to check on an accent or whatever. So I met Jacob and I thought he was just immediately honest, funny, wry, a very keen observer of people, which is why I think his performance is so special. Very, very deft, observational comic, actually. But he, you know, I met him and I hadn't seen Euphoria. I hadn't seen anything he'd been in yet. And I actually didn't realize that he was obviously such a massive star when I met him. But he was so candid and interesting. And then when he came into audition, he just blew everyone out of the water because what he did and noticed and what nobody else did and noticed, even though they did beautiful, beautiful work, was that actually his character is sort of weak, sort of not special, sort of horrible, but not in a way that's unusual. He's sort of, you know, he made him a real person. And that was very, very difficult to find. And with Barry, I'd already seen so much of his work, but I hadn't seen him do an English accent. So I asked if he'd ever done an audition. I got his managers and agents. I asked if he'd ever done an audition in an English accent for something else, if I could see it. And I saw something that he'd done, and it was for something quite surprising, actually. And again, it was just that feeling I always have with him where I'm just like, I was watching it on my laptop and I could feel my face getting closer to the screen, because almost the closer you get with Barry, the more enigmatic you become. The charisma is just off the chart. But it's always about, you know, it is trying to be honest. And I think the thing is on, you know, it's that we can all speak quite plainly to each other in every department. And that's very difficult, obviously, when you're the director, because people, you know, the instinct always, all the actors, the instinct is to manage you. The instinct is to kind of, is to sugar the pill a bit. But I just don't, you know, you don't fucking have time on set for a pill to be sugared. And so for me, I really want people to be honest with me as much as they can be, or they feel they can be, in a nice way. So we can all kind of, what Josie said, which was so nice about working on something like Saltburn, is we're always operating on the brink of failure. That's a really important thing. You have to be on that edge always of something going too far, something being too complicated, too overwrought, whatever it is. That's where the interesting stuff happens. To get there, you've got to trust each other and you've got to be honest. And so I, as an actress, hated more than anything the sense of people at a monitor talking and then somebody creeping up to you and kind of then sort of saying something and you just be like, just tell me what you're talking. I don't need the journey of you discovering how to just ask me. And so when I hope that with actors, I hope I'm always kind and collaborative and all of those things. But I also will say, I hope, the thing, you know, that I mean, you know, like if people are, you know, if there's a moment when everyone's like, oh, we're just having a bit of a, we can't quite make, sometimes I'm just like, okay, come on, lads. It's just, let's just stand there and say our lines and see if it works out, shall we? Rather than standing here for hours having a conversation about it. Let's just have a go. You know, it's sort of, it's that thing of like all being in it together and being able to like joke with everyone. And so that really, really helps.
And the film is set in 2006, and I, as someone who was in college around that time, the pop culture references are so good. Like, you're flown back to that moment so quickly. Was there a certain one that, like, was the one you had to get, whether that was one of the songs or one of the movies that are referenced? Like, what was the pop culture reference you're sort of most proud of that's in there?
I think the Livestrong bracelet that Felix wears really hurt.
I completely forgot about those until you see it.
And it's the sort of boy who was wearing them at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of it was so wonderful because, you know, as brilliant Susie Davis, who's the unbelievable production designer, said, you know, we treated it like a, you know, it's a period drama. Mm-hmm. And actually, you have to be even more careful when you're dealing with the recent past because you can so easily let things slip through the net. But all of it, you know, for example, the BlackBerry ringtone,
right.
God almighty. I mean, that gave me proper shivers when I heard it, you know, sort of like an awful, but all of it, it's just, you know, it's that texture. And what's so great about it is when you're dealing with beauty, when you're talking about film, you know, you're talking about surface versus the kind of sticky underbelly, and you're talking about beauty and what beauty does to us all, you know, kind of drives us all insane. In order to humanize it, everyone looks a little bit lame because the recent past is a little bit lame. And that made, you know, it was wonderful that because of the Gothic structure, we had to have, you know, some a narrator telling us about something that happened in the past, but the fact that it also humanized all these unbelievably beautiful characters. I mean, you know, Felix's Carpe Diem tattoo. Mm-hmm. Just knocks a couple of gorgeous points off naturally. It's like if somebody like screeches up to your front door, the most beautiful person in the world screeches up to your front door, but they've got a personalized number plate that says like legend. What are you willing to overlook?
And when it comes to sort of capturing that era, you know, I'm interested because you see things like Superbad or a Flo Rida song, and you're like, those, was the main goal to sort of capture what it felt like in those mid-2000s? Because those, I think, came out like the end of the summer, right? Or the fall. I don't know the exact dates, but how much about, was it like, that is a movie that I remember from like the mid-2000s feelings?
Yeah, well, it's actually 2007 that most of the film is set, because of course it says Welcome Class of 2006, but that's the beginning of the school year. And so,
right,
past Christmas. So it's actually 2007. So everything is very much to the time that it was brought out. We were very, very specific about that stuff. So Superbad had come out already, and they would have been able to get it on DVD. We checked all of that stuff meticulously. I can't, you know, if you're going to be specific, you've got to be really specific. It's a really tricky one. You need to have some space in order to understand. I suppose if you're making a satire, we can't see ourselves clearly in the immediate moment. And the thing is, as if they'd been, you know, I suppose they could have been watching Succession, you know, maybe. And they could have been listening to, I don't know, like Bad Bunny or whatever, but it wouldn't feel, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Because those things haven't been, I think the thing is that everything now in pop culture seems cool because it's in pop culture. Mm-hmm. And you don't want them to feel cool. You want to kind of, you need to understand that, you know, with a bit of distance, that you can understand that all of us are human, that all of us at our fixed points can be really cool and beautiful, but actually we're just following trends like everyone else. And it was so much about this family, this extraordinary family living this extraordinary life, are still part of the world in some funny way. And it just, it felt much, much more, it felt much easier to make those, to show those things in the recent past than it would have done now. They'd have seemed too cool.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, and I feel like this question doesn't even make sense after hearing about your process of writing something, but with this film coming out, is what's next already clear to you?
Yeah.
You know.
It's clear to me, and it's really, do you know what it's like? It's like having a new boyfriend or falling in love. It's that same feeling. It's like when I don't write, I get very anxious and I start to feel a bit mad. And I haven't obviously, you know, written, I haven't had the kind of like time to do the writing, or the kind of mind writing, since Saltburn went in, you know, since I delivered Saltburn. And so I can feel myself being pulled already away, you know. I love Saltburn so, so deeply, and I'm so excited talking about it, but there's part of my brain that's like, you know, like that part of you when you just want to go and like make out with your new boyfriend. That's kind of how I feel about this new thing, is I can feel myself being pulled there, you know, already, and it's just so exciting.
So now, David, we're going to hear the interview you did with Andrew Scott, the star of All of Us Strangers. And much like some of the interviews we had last week with Charles Melton and Jeffrey Wright, it's a movie that you saw when the actors were still on strike and were just kind of itching to be able to actually talk to him about it. And I'm hoping it finally lived up to expectations when you got to talk to him about this movie.
Very much so. I've been a fan of his for a long time. I think we talked on the show about his performance as Hamlet, that Richard and I are big fans of. And of course, Fleabag and a lot of his stage and television work. But in terms of film, this is a huge breakthrough role for him and long overdue. And yeah, we got into it. I was relieved we finally got to get into it.
And something that you've written about before, we've talked about on the show, but I feel like we should let you platform one more time, is that Andrew Scott is one of very few openly out gay actors and would make some Oscar history this year if All of Us Strangers goes all the way.
Yeah, both he and Colman Domingo are kind of in that conversation in a way that's both exciting and maybe depressing for how long it has taken since an openly gay actor has been nominated in this category, going back to Ian McKellen, who's the only one. But I think that what's especially gratifying about his candidacy for this movie is he's playing a really nuanced queer character, one, and two, the beauty of the film is that it's so infused with personal experience. Andrew Haig talked to us a lot about that in our first look at the film, you know, from filming in his childhood home to really capturing this era of growing up gay in London. And Andrew Scott also brought a lot of personal experience to this role and to this film in a way that I think adds tremendous texture to his performance.
I would agree. Let's hear your conversation with the star of All of Us Strangers, Andrew Scott.
Andrew Scott, thanks so much for being here. We're talking All of Us Strangers, which everyone who listens to this podcast knows is one of my favorite movies of the year.
Wow, really? That's great.
Yes, very, very much so. I talked to your director, Andrew Haig, quite a while ago about it. And it's a movie that lingers. I'm sure that's the same for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it is.
Yeah. I'm sure when you get a script like this and it's so nuanced and so finely tuned that it's a pretty easy yes. What I'm curious about to start with for you is if you knew what it would require of you right away, you know, the emotional intensity that a role like this would demand for any actor, but sort of how you figured that out as the script came your way.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There was something I saw in the role, I guess, that I understood immediately. I didn't have any fear about it, about showing that sort of, I kind of immediately knew that I would have to go to a childish place within myself, a place that I feel like I've escaped from, which is a place of real loneliness and fear and, I suppose, lack of self-confidence that I think is sort of beautiful within the character. And to go to a childish place, really, where you can't even really explain what you feel is different about you, but just that you do feel that way, and what you might have to do to survive, and what you may have to conceal, and the burdens and kind of accidental cruelties that you have to face. I loved the idea that I could get to to express that in some way.
What did it feel like to go back to some of those feelings that you're talking about?
I went to see the film for the first time with an audience only last week because of the
strike. Yeah.
Strike. And I'd seen it, you know, in the screening room. And I have to say, I felt like, wow, I felt like I was sort of sitting naked in a room of 350 people. I know that, you know, there's a certain degree of nakedness in the movie anyway, physical nakedness.
Yes, but more layers of nakedness.
Layers of nakedness. But I felt like, wow, I was kind of alarmed by kind of raw it felt. But that's okay. That's my job.
Yeah, it's the unique thing about film, and especially films like this. I know you just come off of a big Vanya run, and that's a different kind of thing because it's not being played back at you, and you don't have the opportunity to watch it as many times as you'd like.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing in the theater. Theater is like performance art. It's like the only art form where you don't actually see the product of what you're doing. You write a book, you can see the book, you make a drawing, you can see the drawing. Even in film, you can see the stuff. Whereas in theater, I think one of the liberating things is that you never actually have to look at it. So you're free to express yourself. So sometimes watching yourself in a film, particularly one that requires so much of me, we shot the film in Andrew's childhood home, and I thought that was such a generous and vulnerable thing to do and on Andrew's part. And so I felt like it was such a privilege to be able to play this part. There's no way that I was ever going to draw on really anybody else's experience but my own and bring that, even if that makes me feel vulnerable. I don't really mind. In fact, I think it's kind of a bit of an honor to be able to show that side of you. And the fact that people might feel seen as a result of our work is genuinely magical.
Hmm. Knowing your work, and particularly your versatility, I hadn't seen you in a mode like this exactly before, at least on screen. Did you feel like a different kind of actor, especially having to plumb the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Yeah, I feel like I wanted it to be unadorned. You always wanted to be slightly unadorned in order to be to feel playful, but I knew that character so well as soon as I read it. And I wanted to honor Andrew's story. I've never met Andrew's parents and he's never met mine, but I felt like that character had to sort of be a weird marriage between me and Andrew. And there's just something that I felt like he was speaking about, and something that I love watching it in acting particularly, which is the nuance of the way people behave and the fact that they might say something that they don't particularly mean. And I think what's very interesting about All of Us Strangers is that it concerns itself with what I think is quite a common experience for queer people, in the sense that it's not all-embracing acceptance from their family, nor is it outright rejection, but it's somewhere in between where they still are there and they sort of say they still love you, but they also say things that are awkward and cruel and ask questions and say things that really are kind of brutal with the hope of understanding. I think that can happen not just for queer people, but within a lot of all sorts of families. And I think that was such an authentic representation of what not only familial love is, but also the other kind of love, the romantic love, and the tentative, beautiful, terrifying nature of falling in love.
The run through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
How did Andrew present his vision to you for the movie after you'd read the script? And how did you start talking through that? I mean, it's very true. It feels very true that you're both bringing a ton of yourselves to this character, and the nature of it is so rooted in his expression as a filmmaker. I'm just curious what that collaboration looked like.
He was very, he wears everything very lightly, you know, Andrew. I thought he was going to be a very serious person, you know, because he's not afraid to talk about serious subjects. But he's very sensitive and very kind and very interested in what, you know, I had to say. And he wanted me to bring that, my own stories. And I think we understood each other very, very quickly. It was, of course, really important to me who, because it's such a small cast, what was going to be in it, because it was such a feeling of love and tenderness in the film. And he really loves actors. He's really
yeah,
appreciative of them, and he's so unsentimental. So the vision of it was, I knew he would cover. And my job, I think, was to express a very particular type of thing, which is to go back and give the audience a sense of childishness without gilding the lily too much. You don't want somebody pretending to be a boy, but you also want a sense of the, you know, the vulnerability of a child, and also somebody who is learning to fall in love as an adult, and how those things are intertwined. And the more he gets confidence from his parents, the more he's seen by his parents, and the more he's able to love himself. And then, of course, when he starts to love himself, he's able to actually love someone else. So it's so much about being, you know, to love and be loved is what we all want. And also it was a big, for me, it was a big physical challenge. I don't know if that perhaps is apparent in the watching the film, but it's a very, very tactile film. And just the idea of when you see children, when they want their parents to, they don't want to hear what their parents saying. They say they put their hands over their mouth, you know, when they snuggle up to their mom and they know what it's like, just the smell of our father's sweaters and what their bed might feel like. And all that felt very sensual to me. And even the way he is able to be embraced by his parents and then learns to be the embracer of Harry. I think it's a sort of something that I had to kind of map out silently for myself. And even though it may not be most front-footed thing in the story, it's certainly a big challenge for me as an actor.
There's one scene where, to what you're saying, I felt like you had kind of pulled off a magic trick, and that is when you get into bed, your character gets into bed with his parents, who are played by Claire Foy and Jamie Bell, people in your age range, an age range that would be your parents. When you read a description like that on paper, if I even just say it out loud, it sounds maybe even ridiculous. Yeah. And the way it plays out is incredibly poignant. And that is, I think, a credit to all three of you, but especially you, because you are playing the child in question. So can you walk me through particularly how you mapped that scene out? Because it is, to me, it seemed like it was very challenging. So I do believe you.
Well, it was challenging to a certain degree, but the things that are always the most challenging on a film set are when the script isn't there. They're always the most difficult sets. Mm-hmm. It's when people go, what am I saying this? Why would I never do this? This scene makes no sense. That's when people get a bit narky. And people don't get narky when you're saying these extraordinary lines that feel so, are just so real. Yeah. But that scene that you're talking about, we ended up doing as one shot, where I get into bed with Claire and Jamie, and it focuses on a duologue between Claire and I. And then there's a kind of camera trick as well as a magic trick where where two other characters arrive. And so it was a sort of a big marriage. Is one of the things I love about filmmaking, between doing quite a long scene. I think it's 5 or 6 minute scene, where you have to really be engaged, and it's one camera, and then the camera moves and someone's there and someone disappears, and it's a really beautiful cinematic achievement on Andrew's behalf. And I feel very proud of it. All of us did that together. And it takes work, and it's sort of, when you say it's ridiculous, when you're talking about the practicalities of it, I mean, we were really laughing in places because there were people getting in bed and out of bed, and there was a whole sort of choreography that had to take place in order for that scene to be created. But that's what I love about it. It's magic, and I love the fact that people are like, "Wow, how did that happen in that scene?" And it's a really beautiful scene, I think.
Yeah. Why do I feel this way and not this way when I read again? Yeah, it's really something.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the personal quality of this role, you didn't fear it. I wonder about the prominence of the role. I mean, I think this is the biggest film role you've had in your career. And that combined with what kind of role it is, like, how did that feel to step into top of the call sheet for this kind of queer character, this kind of queer story, and just in general, a story that was very intimate?
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting about it was I've never really, I played leading characters before, maybe in films that nobody's ever seen. And I've played a lot of leading roles in the theater.
Yes.
I'd actually just finished an absolutely enormous role, ginormous role. I just played Tom Ripley for Steve Zalian, and it's an absolutely enormous role. And we shot that during the pandemic, and it actually went over production by about 5 months. So I'd really done an awful lot of acting, and I was kind of planning actually of taking some time off because it was a big old number, the last one. But I couldn't not do this. But I suppose to answer your question, the nature of the role, I think, was something that I feel is, I suppose that's sort of wonderful. I felt like, yeah, it was really nice to be asked to play the role, because mm-hmm. I'm sure Andrew could have got any number of people to play the part, and I'm grateful that he saw something in me, because in a way he was right to see something in me, because I immediately saw something that I could bring. But, you know, sometimes, you know, your hope as an actor is that people are that you're not going to get pigeonholed, or that people see something in you that you may not always have displayed, or they don't cast you based on your box office opening, or even the fact that you may not have hitherto played loads of leading roles in film. I don't know. I don't know that I've played all these leading roles in, on screen. It doesn't really mean that I'm going to go back to always having to play leading roles. But in this case, I suppose there is something that's kind of wonderful, in the sense, like, when I was growing up, I didn't, the idea that there would even, a film like this would even exist, and that I would be able to play that role in it is miraculous, particularly, you know, feeling out and comfortable. And it's wonderful that it's taken place. I really am thrilled about it. And I'm also thrilled about the fact that it's being advertised, that they're not shying away from the fact that it's mm-hmm. In part a love story about between two men. And that's great. That's really, really wonderful. Truly.
Yeah. When I say prominence, I think that extends beyond the, you know, what you do in the movie and the life it leads, right? I mean, you have Searchlight Pictures behind this movie. You couldn't promote it at the beginning, obviously, but there was a real prominence, and there has been in this campaign. So as you've been able to, you know, suddenly get out there for this movie, how have you experienced that part of it? Just the level of support for a movie like this, and the level of attention, frankly, that it's getting.
Extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I love the fact that, you know, I was really disappointed not to be able to go to Telluride, even though in another way I was glad that the fight was being fought.
Yes.
But I love the fact that it was a sort of, what's the word, underdog. I don't think people were, and so that's the magic of cinema. Like, if you make something that's really, if you build it, they will come. Like, if you create something that's really unique and special, it's very hard to even label exactly what genre this movie is, which I think is one of its strong points. So yeah, the fact that now people are passionate about the film, and people seeing it two or three times, and I saw it the other night for the first time, and it does have something about it that is magical. There's no doubt. And I've been in a lot of things where something is highly respectable and admirable and enjoyable and all those things, but it's kind of rare that you have something that you think there's something about this that is both very particular and completely universal, and something where audience, different types of audience members, gay, straight, whatever their happens in their walk of life, is people respond to it in completely different ways. And it's really interesting doing the press tour with it, because the people go, the line that really struck me was, and invariably are they completely different lines. The bit mm-hmm. that really punched me in the heart was this part. And you think, wow, that's completely different to what that last mm-hmm. person said. And that has to be down, I think, to the specificity of the script.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I think also to the tenderness really between the four of you.
Yeah.
And I know you've been out a bit with Paul getting the movie out of late, and it seems like this, I mean, I'm projecting a little bit, it seems like this is a bond that has lasted past the filming of the movie. But how did you find, you know, developing this relationship on screen with him, and clearly continuing to experience the movie together thereafter?
Oh, I adore Paul. This is plain and simple. I just love him. We have a very special bond. We didn't know each other particularly well. We knew each other a little bit before making the film, and I think we're both quite pleased that we didn't. I think it added something to this kind of burgeoning relationship, because we had a burgeoning relationship ourselves. And now that we know each other better and we've gone through this very intimate thing together, and the fact that we both worked so hard, you know, we're both hard workers, and so to be able to sort of enjoy people's response to it, and to be able to talk about it, I adore him. I really do. I love him. I think he's a really uniquely gifted, generous actor, and he's just so fun. And I don't know, I just think we're both so grateful to be in a film like this. We're both big movie lovers, and I really could not have asked for a better colleague than Paul.
We referred to the nakedness earlier. I'm sure you're being asked about the sex scenes. I am going to ask you specifically about if it is the choreography of them, like what it actually, the experience of actually filming them and having that level of trust with Paul. When I spoke with Andrew Haig about it, he described the two of you as quite fearless. I'm wondering how you hear that.
Yeah, I didn't really feel, I suppose you have a little degree of fear. But those scenes, you know, a lot can be made of them on the day. You know, like, oh my God, the big sex scenes coming up, and you have an intimacy coordinator. Thank God, I think they're very necessary and wonderful things. But I think it's important to remember that they can be choreographed, but you still have to be present and you still have to listen.
Yeah.
Sex is communication in exactly the way the same conversation is communication, a verbal conversation. So that's what I loved about it, was that we had a sort of framework of where we'd go, but how do you portray nervousness? How do you portray lust? How do you portray all those things? That's really a really interesting one. And, you know, Paul and I's chemistry in real life is actually kind of irrelevant. There's a skill that's required that's actually beyond chemistry, that you have to go, well, our chemistry is one thing, but we're talking about the chemistry between Adam and Harry, these two characters, which is completely different. You know, I was playing a very lonely kind of, I suppose at that time, quite repressed character, which I don't feel, you know, in my own life. And that's a great challenge. It's wonderful because it speaks to me of empathy, and that's what our jobs are. So it was, you know, all the things. It was kind of a bit scary at the beginning, and then you kind of get more used to it. And, you know, he's great fun. And I think the great good thing about working with somebody that you love is that the process is really enjoyable, because I know people who can't stick each other can have great chemistry and the outcome can be wonderful, but the process is nightmarish. So the fact that it was so pleasurable and that the outcome has been so special is really genuinely unique.
In terms of the repressed nature of this character and the particular ways in which he does show affection, can you share some specifics or insights into how you determined that this man would be romantic, and particularly with this character?
Yeah. Well, I kind of feel like I wanted to map it out. He wouldn't have really touched many people in a long time. And so the fact that he's conjured up these two people who are the first people in most of our lives that we are affectionate with, that we show physical affection towards, and the fact that he's gradually getting to know them while simultaneously meeting someone that he initially shuts out, and the balance between those two stories, I think, is very expertly achieved. And they have to affect each storyline. That's what I think is very is the great balancing act. So I was really interested in the nature of physicality in the playing of this part. It may not seem it on it doesn't look like it's a particularly physical role, but actually for me it was very physical to be as close to your mother as possible, to feel like you're smaller than these people, even though they're not physically any bigger than you. To be, you know, childish without gilding the lily too much, and to make the audience feel like they did when they were a child without it being gimmicky, was really important. So it's just really using your imagination, and then at the same time becoming more confident sexually. I don't know, for me it was just being able to map it out as much as possible, and that sort of takes a lot of, I suppose it takes a lot of mental work and my imagination about when you should, what note you should play, and more specifically when you should play it.
Especially a movie that does exist in this kind of metaphysical realm, right? I mean, it's interesting that you have this very realistic style of acting, style of sex, style of relationships, and it's in this expression that's kind of another plane.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think that I love that juxtaposition, actually. In the theater, you know, when people play multiple roles, or, you know, we accept it immediately. We go, oh, wow, okay, that's great. And, you know, that's yep. the convention within the theater. And we don't do that so much in screen work. And I think sometimes we can afford to be a little bit more audacious. You know, I love the fact that there isn't a kind of nuclear glow around Claire or Jamie to signify that they are who they are, because that felt actually in playing those scenes, it just felt immediately, it didn't feel, oh my God, this is ridiculous. I felt like this is really easy to play because we had to engage our imaginations, which is our first job as actors, is to power into that imagination. So that's how I would characterize my experience for the most part, is to really engage in that part of me that, you know, exists and is within me in so many ways. And it's just about, you know, digging around a bit.
Yeah. So it was interesting hearing you talk about Tom Ripley earlier, because I was going to ask you if this was a role where bringing all this, you know, the pain you were talking about into the part, it was tough to take home, perhaps. I would imagine Ripley is also a very tortured character, at least in previous iterations. I can't say I know what you guys are doing, but I would guess it was. There's a certain level of psychological intensity. But, you know, come doing these projects, you know, one after the other, was that a lot psychologically for you?
Yeah. Not so much this one, but I feel like, you know, you're required to sort of love your characters and advocate for your characters, and you have to, your job is to go, what's that? You don't play the sort of previous attitudes that people might have about Tom Ripley. That's the thing that you have to be a bit like, you have to throw all those out and try not to listen to them and go, okay, well, I have to have the courage to create our own version and my own understanding of the character. But it was a heavy part to play. I found it mentally and physically really hard. I found it tough. You know, that's just the truth of it. So in a way it was a balm in some ways to play this character, because I suppose the journey to understanding this character was a less arduous one than trying to understand what Tom Ripley does. Certain things I can understand, but other things you could go, it's actually the blankness that's sometimes hard to engage with. I can't bring my own experience of murder to the...
would hope not.
I would hope not. Well, certainly that's maybe not something that I should admit to you today.
Not on the record anyway.
Exactly.
Well, Andrew Scott, we will leave it there. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
That does it for today's show. We will be back on Thursday. Find us at Vanity Fair, on social media at VF Awards Insider. I am around social media at Katie Rich, and David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.